from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, last April's shooting attack on a PG&E substation in San Jose was, quote, the most significant incident of domestic terrorism involving the grid that has ever occurred. That's according to former Federal Energy Regulatory Commission Chair John Wellinghoff. We'll talk with him and other experts about that incident and about why it was not known for quite a while in terms of its details and about security of the nation's electrical grid. It's all coming up on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last April, a nighttime attack destroyed a power substation in the heart of San Jose. The perpetrators broke into an underground vault off Highway 101 and cut fiber optic cables. And the attackers also fired on the substation for about 20 minutes, apparently with semi-automatic weapons, and demolished 17 of 23 transformers. PG&E blamed the incident on vandalism, and the damage took a month to repair. And the former head of the Federal Regulatory Commission at the time of the incident, John Wellinghoff, has said it could have been a trial run to bring down substantial parts of the electric grid, and he blamed the incident on well-trained professionals. Pentagon officials apparently agree with that assessment. To date, there have been no arrests. How vulnerable is the grid to cyber attack? And is the grid on an Achilles heel for potential terrorism? We want to take up those questions and more in this morning's opening Forum Hour. And joining us in studio is Rebecca Smith. She's a staff reporter with the Wall Street Journal who broke the story. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us by phone is John Wellinghoff, whom I alluded to earlier, former chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, San Francisco-based partner at the law firm of Stoll Rives LLP. He was head of FERC when San Jose's Metcalf Power Station was attacked. John Wellinghoff, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
And we also want to say good morning to Jim Fema, who is vice president of energy delivery with Edison Electric Institute. That's the association that represents all U.S. investor-owned electric companies. And he's with us from the nation's capital. Jim Fema, good to have you aboard. Welcome to you.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for having me today.
Good to have you. And it's FAMA, isn't it? No, I'm saying FAMA.
It is FAMA.
FAMA. Okay, sorry about that.
No problem.
Let me begin, if I may, with Rebecca Smith, who's here with us in studio, who, again, was with the Wall Street Journal, and they broke this story. And this was not a story that got, I should say, a lot of attention. In fact, Jim Woolsey, some San Franciscans may remember, the former head of the CIA, was in town back in October of 2013 and talked about this as probably being calculated and not being, at this point, something that people knew enough about. In fact, he said it was in a systematic attempt to bring down the electric grid. The media seemed to miss this story, except for the Wall Street Journal, Rebecca Smith, which is strange in itself, but a lot to do with PG&E being fearful that there would be copycats, I guess.
Huh? I think absolutely, Michael. PG&E was afraid that if people knew that this had been a rather systematic attack, it might either encourage copycats or also might impede the investigation, you know, obviously the attempt to find who these people were and arrest them. They still remain at large, as you pointed out.
Well, the FBI has downplayed terrorism as well. They said they need a motive to be able to figure out terrorism or call it terrorism.
I think they may be taking a rather literal definition of terrorism. I mean, I think the average person would say if you have a planned attack, that is a terrifying incident.
And we know it was a planned attack just because how systematic it was done and how professionally it was done.
Yes, as you pointed out, they tried to cut the telecommunications before the attack began. They then took down certain pieces of equipment, doing so in such a way that it would not cause a fire or an explosion. And if a person went in and just began unleashing random gunfire, there is a lot of flammable material in a substation. There would have been, almost without question, a fire. That didn't happen. And 70 seconds before the police arrived, the individuals disappeared. So they seem to have known, seem to have had a lookout or something of the sort.
There have been a number of these incidents overseas, a number of attacks on transmission lines, or at least from what we've been able to determine on substations. Has there been any connection that we know of to terrorism there? Anybody been brought to justice?
I don't feel competent to answer that. I mean, I think, you know, we're looking to the FBI to solve this case. I don't know about what has happened, except that there have been thousands of incidents in other places around the world, obviously, especially in war-torn countries like Iraq.
Well, the Wall Street Journal did take stock of cyber incidents that occurred here over the past 3 years, and I think the tally was about 274, mostly actually vandalism. Most of them had to do with either disgruntled employees or people stealing metal, those kinds of things. You know?
Right. There actually, a lot of attacks happen on utility equipment each year. But what does not happen is we do not have people taking out systematically a substation that's supplying power to Silicon Valley. That's what sets this one apart.
Well, Rich London, who's with the Electric Power Research, senior tech advisor to them, said it looked like preparation for an act of war. Does that sound too hyperbolic or exaggerated to you?
It sounded like an unusually strong statement for someone who works within the utility industry, and I think that's why we used it in the story. This is not the way people normally describe acts of vandalism.
Bigger threat than hacking, we could say quite definitively, couldn't we?
Yes, I think so.
Well, let me bring John Wellinghoff into this. And John Wellinghoff, if the right targets were coordinated, it could knock off power for most of North America. We know that, don't we? And you're pretty convinced that this was planned in a professional way for whatever reasons or motives?
Yeah, I'm not only convinced, but again, been advised by members of the DOD, the Department of Defense, that I actually took to the site shortly after it occurred, and we walked the site, and those individuals were the ones who convinced me that this was a very well-planned, coordinated, and implemented attack in a way that we haven't seen before. I mean, again, as Rebecca indicates, there have been many, many instances of physical vandalism on the power grid, and that happens periodically every month. But this stands head and shoulders above anyone in we've ever seen in preparation and execution. So it is very concerning, and it's concerning, again, as to the effect if someone were to undertake a coordinated attack on a number of critical substation nodes in the country, what the impact and effect would be. That's why I've been trying to emphasize that what we really need to do, and I know that the utilities are moving very quickly on it, and that is to ultimately try to protect these substations.
Well, what else is concerned here is I don't believe there are any government agencies accountable for safeguarding the power grid, are there?
Well, FERC has the responsibility, that my former agency, to ensure the grid is reliable. But no agency has the responsibility to look at known threats and vulnerabilities, as this one is, as certain cyber attacks are as well, and ultimately to formulate rapidly a mitigation plan and to put that plan into place. FERC, through its process, through FERC and its and the agency that it designated as the reliability organization, NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Council, can formulate reliability rules. Those rules are formulated through industry stakeholder committees that develop them through NERC, and then they give them up to FERC to formulate into final rules that can be enforced, but that whole process can take anywhere from 12 to 18 months to 36 months. And what we have here is a situation I think requires a more rapid response.
Well, I want to talk to you about what that response might be, but I think it's fairly safe to say that these grids are not adequately protected at this point. And the fact of the matter is, I'll be very blunt with you. The power companies fear legal liability if they alter security systems, even if they shore up the defenses there?
I'm not sure if it's an issue of legal liability. Certainly there's an issue of costs, and utilities are very sensitive to increasing expenses for lots of different things, including cybersecurity and others. That's why, you know, I've been advocating that the costs for any kind of improvement to the security, physical security of these critical nodes, and I'd say that there's less than 100 of them in the country. There's, you know, thousands of substations, but the ones that are most critical, the high voltage ones that are most critical, there's not that many, but the costs to harden those should be spread over all the taxpayers, and we need to do this through some national legislation, perhaps some change to the tax laws, because ultimately, if you're protecting a grid, for example, of PG&E here in California, and protecting their critical substations, the protection of that's going to help people in Nevada and help people in Arizona and Montana. Ultimately, it helps the entire Western Interconnect ensure that that Western Interconnect can stay up. So that's why the cost should be spread over all of the taxpayers in the country, because it really is a national issue.
It's also a prophylactic cost. I mean, you're talking about large transformers that cost millions of dollars and are very hard to replace if something go wrong on that score. But a lot of these substations are in rural areas, and they're not terribly well protected.
That's correct. I mean, most all of them, even in the urban areas like this one in San Jose and Metcalf, are only protected by a chain link fence and a few cameras and a few lights. And beyond that, there's very little protection for any of these facilities. That's correct.
And what about surveillance drones? I know Jeff Bezos would like to see the FAA legalizing commercial use of drones, but, I mean, that's a plausible scenario, isn't it, to get involved in this along with digital and other kinds of sensors?
There are more sophisticated sensing technologies. I've had people contact me since this story came out, Rebecca's story came out in the Wall Street Journal, with things like ability to actually acoustically sense bullets going off, and apparently there's the FBI and law enforcement use technology to do that in high crime areas. There's lots of things we can do. I think we need to have a cost-effective priority list of what's the most cost-effective, you know, least expensive things we can do first, and start to do those immediately. In fact, I submitted a checklist to a number of utility executives that I briefed last summer here in San Francisco that outlined the short-term, mid-term, and long-term things that could be done, such things as making the fence opaque, for example, so you can't see the target through it, relatively inexpensive. There's a number of things that can be done, and we need to put together a cost-effective list and figure out a way to pay for them.
Tom Wellinghoff, again, is former chair of FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and Jim Fama is vice president of energy delivery with Edison Electric Institute, and that's the association that represents all U.S. investor-owned electric companies. So at this point, Jim Fama, what's being done to ensure against a repeat performance along the lines of what happened?
Well, Michael, this is a concern that we've been working on for a number of years, and Metcalf certainly is a wake-up call as well. And let me assure you that our CEOs take this very seriously, and our companies have a lot of focus on this issue. We started working on looking at spare transformers, critical equipment in our substations back in 2006, and in fact put together a program to share transformers in the event of just this sort of situation, an attack that damages a substation. In fact, we filed it with FERC when John was on the commission, and FERC was very supportive of the program. And we have 51 companies in it, and it is a system that looks at if there's an emergency situation and utilities reach out to their colleague utilities, if you will, would there be enough transformers available for the utilities to share, to reconfigure their system, and to serve their load. So, Michael, it's a mix of hardening your system, as John said, with measures to protect your substations, and then also it's a question of resiliency. If you do have an incident, do you have enough redundancy and resiliency built into your system to ultimately serve your customers? And of course, that's what Pacific Gas and Electric had in its system. They didn't lose a single customer due to the incident.
Is there movement toward developing a plan or having some protocols in place, though?
Well, as John said, John provided our companies with a list of best practices and measures short and mid and long term, and EEI did as well. So all of that has gone out to our companies, and they are in the process of reassessing their situation. Also, we've done some work with the commission, and we've done some work on our own to take a look at which substations are most critical. So that's important as well, to identify, where you want to, apply these measures most quickly. Also, you know, you mentioned earlier, Michael, working with federal agencies, you mentioned whether there's a agencies responsible for safeguarding. We have, John described the role of FERC, but we also work with the other agencies, DHS, DOE, the FBI, and we're having a multi-city set of meetings where we go over with local law enforcement and those federal agencies, not only best practices, but, you know, you build the relationships and you learn what the law enforcement people can do to assist in a situation, as well as they get an understanding of the significance of our substations, where they are, and how we operate them.
I know that, and by the way, we're talking to Jim Fama from Edison Electric Institute. I know that PG&E has done some increase in terms of security measures, but it's really going to be up to the utilities to protect the grid. And quite frankly, there was a great deal of loss of confidence, to put it mildly, in PG&E over what happened in San Bruno. I don't know if you can be reassuring on that score.
Well, I have to tell you, it's the utilities are doing a lot. Not only what I already talked about, we drill all of this, both at a national level and in our spare transformer program. We had a recent drill with NERC in November. We had a scenario with a physical and a cyber attack. We look, our spare transformer team looks and drills every summer. Not only where are the transformers that we might need in an emergency, but can we move them? We have arrangements in place with riggers, railroads, trucks, barges, those sorts of things you need to move equipment. We have a mutual assistance network where we can borrow crews from each other to take advantage of, wherewithal we have spread all out all over the country.
Can I get you to comment, and maybe we can hear from John Wellinghoff and Rebecca Smith on this too, about what the real possibilities here are, what is conceivable here. I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about worst-case scenarios, but, you know, what happened after Sandy, for example, or after a tree fell down and power was lost in the eastern part of the United States for about 50 million people back in 2003. I mean, we're talking about something that can be extraordinarily expansive and really cut off power. I mean, this could have cut off power, for example, throughout Silicon Valley, but we're talking about the potential for power being cut off, period.
Well, Michael, you know, again, we have a lot of redundancy built into our systems. And again, you can't build the systems to perfection so that there will never, ever be a customer that goes out. But you do build resilience into your system, and we have a mutual assistance setup, which we employed in Sandy, where, you know, we move crews from as far away as Puget Sound and California and Texas into the East Coast to restore power. We had, in Sandy, just by way of example, we had about 67,000 utility employees on the ground working on restoration. So we have these relationships set up because that's the nature of our business. I mean, you are correct that there's a tremendous economic cost. If power is off, people depend on it 24/7. It's not energy that can be stored. Electricity really can't economically be stored. It has to be there all the time, and we have to be ready to serve at all times.
Let me go to Rebecca Smith on this, because I think you quoted someone in one of your articles, Jerry Cawley, who said that the grid is a lot more resilient than maybe John Wellinghoff thinks. I mean, how do you see things as someone who has talked to both sides and really done a lot of research on it?
I think that the utility industry has done a lot to make the grid resilient. They have spent more than $1 trillion building the grid that we now enjoy. But I think there are some basic vulnerabilities that are enormous. I mean, the deal that was struck 100 years ago was we will allow private companies to own the transmission lines and the distribution lines and the substations, provided they do two things. We don't want to be gouged. We want to make sure they provide us with reliable service. The industry can no longer guarantee the latter. There is a basic vulnerability. These assets are hard to replace. They're terribly expensive. And the sector is not protecting them adequately. I mean, that is simply a fact. We have a flawed structure that regulates utilities right now insofar as physical security goes. We have no standards for physical security. We don't have a good process for creating those standards because the process that exists is industry dominated. And one other thing on the spare equipment program, I think the utilities are doing a lot to try to create a spare equipment program that will work. The problem is transformers are not interchangeable. They are not a standardized product. There are differences even within voltage classes that mean that one transformer could not be a sub for another due to impedances and other technical specifications. This is a huge problem, and leaving it to the industry to satisfy this problem is not going to be effective.
John Wellinghoff, let me get you to comment, particularly on the question of resiliency.
Sure, and I think Rebecca touched on a lot of very important points, but I think the most critical one is that, you know, as long as we have a centralized interconnect-based system that we do, and that we have critical nodes of high-voltage transformers and substations that we do, that the most cost-effective thing to do that I can see is to protect those substations. I mean, and this is not anything new. There was a report that the Comptroller General reported to Congress in 1981 that made suggestions that this is something to do. There was a report by the Congressional Research Service in 2004 that made the same recommendation. There was a report by the National Research Council in 2012 that, again, made the same recommendation that these high-voltage transformers are the most vulnerable part physically of our grid, and they should be protected. And yet we still don't have adequate protection. And I do appreciate, as Jim indicated, you know, the industry is moving in that direction, and they're looking at the lists of individual mitigation measures that both EEI has developed and that FERC handed out. But again, I think we need to move rapidly.
No, in fact, I was just going to mention, if I could, John, sorry to interrupt you, but Con Ed has actually changed a number of the angles in their security areas, about 1,200 to date. But nobody can order these utilities to improve the grid, right?
Currently, nobody can order them to improve this physical security short of putting in place a FERC rule that would go through NERC and, again, that would take, you know, perhaps a year or more to implement ultimately. That's correct.
Well, let me find out what's on our listeners' minds in response to this. We're talking really about the vulnerability of the power grid and some questions, particularly in the light of what occurred last April in a shooting attack on a PG&E substation in San Jose that according to former FERC chairman John Wellinghoff, whom we've just been talking to, was the most significant incident of domestic terrorism involving the grid that has ever occurred. Our phone lines are available to you, and we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions or comments, please feel free to join us now. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us, and we welcome your involvement in the program. And join the conversation toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Rebecca Smith, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, John Wellinghoff, who is former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and Jim Fama, vice president of energy delivery with Edison Electric Institute. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with a number of experts about an incident that occurred last April that really did not initially get a lot of immediate attention. The Wall Street Journal, to their credit, made us to a greater extent aware of the story when it was reported by Rebecca Smith about the security of the nation's electrical grid. And just saying to me off air that this is in covering energy. We talked 10 years ago about Enron with you. 20 years, this has been your beat. You've done a lot of research and a lot of yo-person work on the subject. What's the scariest thing you've encountered?
I think it's terrifying, and I will just say that. I think that this is a huge vulnerability we have. I think that we cannot go forward without addressing it. I feel this absolutely in the strongest terms. I mean, and I've been covering the sector. This is all I've written on for the last 15 years is electricity.
And Jim Fama, the burden is on the utilities here, but the utilities, as much as they may be trying, again, don't necessarily inspire the kind of confidence, and nobody's compelling them to do what needs to be done. And they're always about saving money.
Well, Michael, let's take those points in turn. First, we'll talk about the money issue. Our regulators, including John Wellinghoff when he was at FERC, and our state regulators have been extremely supportive on cost recovery for reliability measures. Our spare transformer program that I talked about that went into place in 2006, 50 companies involved, many state commissions were, again, extremely supportive and allow immediate cost recovery. As far as the other point about utilities being compelled, I think you have to understand that this is our business. This is the nature of our business to supply electricity on a continuous basis. We're in a public service business. We understand our importance to the economy. Of course, we have every interest in the world, like any business, to keep our customers online and those meters turning, because those are our revenues. We have all of those drivers to keep electricity on. So I don't think we really it's a question of being compelled to provide good service.
We're not talking about service so much as we're talking about security, though, aren't we?
Well, and we are moving forward on security. I mean, John went through a number of items, and I can tell you our companies are engaged right now in looking at putting in and installing and doing a lot of things that John talked about. And as John is correct, a lot of them are not that expensive, inhibiting line of sight, barriers, shielding equipment, cameras, lighting, detection, monitoring, that sort of thing. Also, a lot of our companies have put into their capital programs, Michael, for the next 3 to 5 years, significant amounts of money. If you look at Dominion, one of our companies here in Virginia, they recently announced that they've got upwards of $500 million in capital improvements associated with hardening their system.
All right. We do have a number of calls and emails that we want to get to here. In fact, our first caller, I think, has a question for you, Jim, and that's Ryan. Ryan, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Jim, my question for you was, you had mentioned previously that the attack was okay, was manageable because of the redundancy in the grid, and I was just kind of curious, would that have been the same situation had the attack taken place during a more high-use period, for instance, the summertime?
Well, that's a good question. I can't speak to the specifics of the Pacific Gas and Electric system, but as a general matter, utility systems are designed to meet their peak plus a reserve on top of that, rule of thumb, maybe 15%. So they're, you know, planned and designed and operated with this in mind. But, yes, you are correct. During a high load period in cold weather or hot weather, you know, you're closer to your margin as far as your ability to handle contingencies such as what happened with Metcalf.
And, Ryan, let me thank you for your question and go to another caller, and that's Howard. Howard, welcome. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. Given that a rulemaking process would take at least a year and possibly longer, and that the industry and utilities are not necessarily highly motivated to do this on their own, is there anything happening at the executive order level? Is that conversation being had at all? I can take my answer off here.
Yeah. John Wellinghoff, can you help us out there? Do we know of anything on the executive level? Or
I don't know of anything specifically. The president just issued a framework on cybersecurity at the executive level, but I don't know of anything that's been done at the executive level on physical security. Jim Fama mentioned what some of the agencies are doing, that the industry is working in coordination with Homeland Security, and they're having a series of meetings around the country. I think that's certainly a positive step, but
but I don't know of anything else that specifically is being done, and maybe Mr. Fama might.
Oh, maybe Rebecca Smith knows, too. Do you know of anything, Rebecca?
No, I'm not aware of anything, but I do think we should be moving beyond meetings at some point here.
Jim Fama?
Yeah, I can help out on this one. We have CEO industry-wide group, not just investor-owned utilities, but public power municipalities and co-ops that meets with a group called the Electric Sector Coordinating Council. That is DOE and DHS, and other agencies are involved as well. But we meet on to share threat information, intelligence. We get secured briefings. We get to share tools with the government. They've upped our security clearances. That has been mostly focused on cyber, but it is starting to move into the physical realm. So that is a great area where we partner up with the government.
And we'll bring more of your calls on. We'll go next to William. William, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I'm wondering if we think that the grid might become stronger by becoming more distributed. That is to say, with more solar on people's rooftops and then battery storage technology, which I understand is coming online, if that was to serve as a backup for that solar power, if the grid might become stronger because there's less centralized places to attack. And, of course, it also becomes cleaner and more affordable for ratepayers.
Yeah, it's a worthy question. And, in fact, sort of dovetailing on this, I'm going to go to you on this, John Wellinghoff. Bob writes online in our website, all the more reason, that is what we're talking about here, to accelerate a shift to decentralized roof-mounted photovoltaic panels, but instead no doubt we'll spend billions on security for existing centralized facilities.
Well, there's no question to the extent that you decentralize the grid, and you can, in fact, as I talked earlier about, you know, isolating into micro grids or regional, sub-regional grids with more distributed systems, that you can, in fact, make the grid more resilient because you have more individual nodes that can be isolated and separated and stood up, in essence, and maintained separate from other parts that may black out from incurred incidents. So absolutely, I think the caller is absolutely correct.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. But, Rebecca Smith, a number of people are asking about the weapon that was used in this to shoot the Transformers. And I've read AK-47. I've read assault weapons. The fact of the matter is we're talking about some serious weaponry here, are we not?
Well, and John Wellinghoff has more knowledge of this than I do because he was privy to more of the investigation details. But my understanding is what we know is what the caliber of bullet was that was used. It might have been shot from an AK-47. It might also have been shot from some other weapon. This is not the biggest bullet that might have been used. If they'd used bigger, larger caliber bullets, they could actually have hit other pieces of equipment. They could have permanently destroyed the transformers. Instead, they damaged them, but they were not damaged beyond repair. And that's an important distinction, because if they had been destroyed, PG&E would have been out tapping the EEI program that Jim Fama mentioned. And, you know, they might have been out looking for 17 new transformers. That was not the case.
Jim Fama, here's a question in an email from a listener named Gretchen. She says, I'm perplexed about reports of no interruption in service. We live in Morgan Hill, but we're out of town at the time and tried to reach family and several businesses off and on throughout the day following the attack on the Metcalf station. None of our cell phones was successful. We repeatedly received the error message that the circuits were busy. When we got back home, we were told that power and communications were interrupted all over the Morgan Hill area. Why the discrepancy in reporting?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question. She's talking about telephone service, and the service was cut, as you know. The utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, did not lose its ability to communicate across its system. We have separate communication avenues in place. But I'm not really sure what the listener was referring to there.
Well, I think the AT&T lines were cut. In fact, we're getting some calls about it. Rebecca Smith nodding her head here, yeah.
Correct.
Okay, well, let me get another caller on, in fact, who's addressing that. This is Helen from San Carlos. Helen, hi.
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my question is this. I understand that the AT&T's lines were cut in this attack, And the only discussion that is going on at the federal and state level is about the attack on the electric facilities, but not on the communications facilities, which are a very vital part of the economy and infrastructure in this country as well. Why is that conversation not taking place?
Rebecca Smith?
Well, I'm afraid to say maybe because the one writing about it is an electricity reporter. I mean, I'm not a telco reporter. Level three communications and AT&T both had fiber optic cables cut. My understanding is six, but they were repaired the next day. The problem is if you knock out major substations, you could have outages that might last for weeks or even months.
And I thank you for the call, Helen, and let me go to another caller. That's Tony in Sonoma. Tony, you're on.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a retired law enforcement officer here in the Bay Area, and I work with a lot of other retired guys, you know, doing specialized security. And I notice you haven't really said anything about hiring off-duty or retired law enforcement officers for security.
Well, you just brought up the topic here. John Wellinghoff, probably a good idea, maybe.
Hmm? Well, I mean, potentially, yes. If you had guards there, these substations are unmanned. Largely, I mean, to my knowledge, virtually none of them have people 24/7. So at least, you know, having somebody there may not also be that expensive of a mitigation measure among others. I mean, and the other ones that we've talked about, obscuring the view through the fence and other things. But this ultimately may be something. And I know that, you know, there are other countries around the world that, in fact, do have guards at their substations on a 24/7 basis.
And thank you, Tony, for the call. I'm wondering, John Wellinghoff, if you can perhaps give us a kind of better notion of what was in a report. It's my understanding NAS put out a report on terrorism and the electric power delivery system.
The National Research Council?
Yeah, National NRS, yeah.
Right. Yes, they put out
or NRC. Excuse me. Yeah.
Yes. The NRC. They put out a report that I believe was published in 2012 that talked about that. You know, there's general agreement that among security individuals that key high voltage substations are the most worrisome terrorist target within the power transmission system. I'm quoting now from page 33. So this report has been out for a little over a year now, and it feeds on, as I say, earlier reports that I referenced in 2004 and one back all the way back to 1981. So there has been a long-term agreement that these particular facilities, that is, these high-voltage transformers, are the key part of the infrastructure that is most vulnerable to physical attack, and that ultimately it is the part of our infrastructure that we should protect.
Is there any intelligence or any inkling as to what forces might be perilous here or threatening? I mean, you know, you think about Al-Qaeda, obviously, and you think about environmental extremism. There are just so many things that come to mind. I don't even know if that's relevant because the FBI is saying we don't know, and I guess we really don't know. But any inkling?
As far as I know, I mean, again, I've talked to the FBI, and they don't have any specific evidence. And again, I'm not sure that's important. What's important
is the protection.
We know, in fact, somebody can do this. They already did it. They knocked out 17 of them.
Yeah.
And as Rebecca said, they didn't damage them permanently. We don't want them damaged permanently. And so to stop that from happening, we should, you know, proceed with the things that we've been talking about.
And we'll proceed with more of our callers. And Phil joins us next. Phil, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, a couple of years ago, you folks had the emergency manager of the state of California on, and I called in and I said that I had read the 9/11 report, and I wanted a yearly report from him about the 9/11 recommendations, whether or not they're being fulfilled. We need that information, and I think that the Board of Supervisors, the city councils, and the mayors from everyone in the Bay Area should insist upon our state emergency director to report on these issues, because it may not have been reported in the 9/11 commission, but I also said that we should look at the 9/11 commission and all other reports that have come after that. So we need a report from the state level, where they're looking at whether we're fulfilling the 9/11 commission recommendations and recommendations from other reports that have come along.
Well, Phil,
we need state responsibility instead of evasion.
A lot of public officials listen to this program, and I hope your message gets through, and I thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Let me get another caller on right away. Jerome, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Walls have been used to surround and protect substations, and depending on the distance from the transformers, they can either amplify or suppress the sound, and therefore an incidental benefit in protecting the transformers can be depressing the sound if they're built in the correct way.
Jim Fama.
Yeah, that is correct. Transformers can be noisy, and so walls around do shield off the noise from the neighbors, so to speak, particularly when you're in close areas.
Let me go to some emails here. Tom writes that he wants to know about the vulnerability of SCADA, the control network for the grid. Needs software security as well as physical security. John Wellinghoff?
Well, certainly SCADA has been SCADA, I think, is actually SCADA, the way it's pronounced. SCADA, which is the system controls for much of the grid, all aspects, including power plants and transformers and switching gear, has been subject of a lot of discussion.
Excuse me, we need a couple academic courses just to keep up with the acronyms, I think,
well,
from your industry.
No, exactly. But ultimately, you know, it can be vulnerable to cyber attack, but I know that, you know, the utility industry has invested a great deal in this area, and I know that they're doing a tremendous amount to protect their control systems from cyber attack. Physical attack, you know, not so much. I mean, really, physical attack, ultimately, I worry much more about the transformers that we've been talking about, these very vulnerable, long lead time, very expensive pieces of equipment. You know, the SCADA is usually, you know, much smaller, more distributed, less vulnerable from a physical attack perspective, but you do have the cyber issues. But I think the industry is really moving, you know, quite aggressively on the cyber side.
Well, perhaps you can help us, John, to deconstruct a few other initials I have here. I've got a tweet from a listener named Tom who says, aren't the existential risks to the grid EMP attack and or solar CMEs? What is being done to address those?
Electromagnetic pulse is the EMP ultimately, and what was the other
or
one?
Or solar CMEs, and that's what
solar flares, I assume, is what's being
that's
discussed
right.
There. And again, these are other issues that both FERC and the industry are addressing. You know, electromagnetic radiation that can, in essence, disrupt the communications to the grid, and there's ways to mitigate that, and I know that you know there's efforts underway and efforts that have been continuing since I left FERC. It's my understanding, and Jim Fama, in fact, maybe you know more up in the most recent activity in this area, but I know the industry is moving forward in these areas.
Jim Fama, want to address it?
Yes, on the solar issue, what we call geomagnetic disturbances, there is a NERC standard in place on that, and a successor standard is being developed. John's successor, Cheryl LaFleur, who's acting chairman of FERC, is very interested in GMD, so she's been moving forward with the industry on that.
And here's a listener named Frank who says, the guest who suggested that the larger community should share the cost of protecting grid nodes because the nodes serve the larger community has somehow managed to miss what is going on politically. One of the parties believes that problems don't get solved by community participation, rather that everyone is on their own. The guests might want to look into the efforts to take a community approach to addressing health, wages, education, and immigration issues to see the problem. I think it was you, John Wellinghoff, who talked about community support here, and he's pointing out, obviously, strong polarization in terms of political parties. Want to comment?
Well, and all I'm suggesting is that ultimately, if you harden these individual high impact nodes of the grid, these high voltage substations, that you are benefiting everybody in the interconnect, so the cost should be spread over everybody who in essence receives benefits, and that seems to me like a federal tax issue rather than a ratepayer expense issue from a standpoint of who actually should pay. Should just the PG&E and just the Southern California Edison ratepayers pay for hardening their high voltage, high impact
substation nodes, if in fact those nodes protect people out in Nevada and Arizona and Montana, et cetera. Well, no, I don't think so. I think everybody should pay those costs. That was my point.
Is there a way, though, to decide if you're hardening the most critical targets, what those targets potentially are?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we ran studies at FERC while I was there with my engineers, and you can prioritize these substations, and I think Jim mentioned that in fact they're doing that. So you can run load flow studies and determine which ones are the most critical.
And Jim Fama, what about ensuring replacement stockpiles, for vital equipment, determining at least what is the most vital in terms of equipment?
Well, it is, as I said, we have our spare transformer program. That's important. We have, but there's other equipment besides transformers that we keep stores on. And of course, we had a test run during Hurricane Sandy on how well we were equipped with all sorts of things, small transformers, poles, bushings, all the equipment you have in substations. So we have a system set up for that. We also have, we're building a network, we call it as a successor to our spare transformer program, to hook up together the people, the contact people that have the equipment and operate equipment in certain areas so that they can share readily, whether they're even in the United States or even in Canada.
Let me go to some more online and email comments. Actually, a question from a listener, Joe Wellinghoff. Let me go to you on this, John Wellinghoff. Excuse me. Regina, who says, if this incident is a suspect terrorist attack, why isn't the National Guard guarding power plants?
Well, I mean, ultimately, that's not what we do in this country. What we do is we in fact, have the FBI investigate. They do have it under investigation. I have every confidence in the FBI that they're, doing everything they possibly can to find the perpetrators, and then from there, we're going through a process to determine how to best protect these individual critical parts of our infrastructure. I mean, we don't bring out the National Guard for everything.
Let me read another online comment from Peter, who says, can't miss this opportunity to encourage utilities to underground urban and rural electric, telephone, and cable lines wherever and whenever possible, as soon as possible. Undergrounding wires that cut the sky is such a win-win in terms of security and aesthetics, an integration of safety with day-to-day happiness, and let's not forget the threat of strange and violent weather incidents in this regard. And more of your online comments. Here's Robert, who writes, the Metcalf substation incident was disturbing and alarming. However, when people who are not working power system engineers begin making what appear to be technical assertions about a particular incident, I'm uneasy. I'm not a power distribution engineer, but I have been an electrical engineer for 35 years. And whenever I hear the phrase the grid tossed around, my experience is that nonsense often follows. Ms. Smith tells us that this subject is all she's written about for 15 years, and I'm sure her opinions are well informed. But is there a working power distribution engineer available to comment? Have you talked to any of those, Rebecca?
Many.
And?
And, I mean, in my experience, large technical organizations that are engineer-dominated, and this would be true of the utility sector, often have blind spots. So sometimes outsiders can identify blind spots. That's really the value of a free press, I think.
Hear, hear. And here's Jeremy, who writes, there are some who have been warning about the security of our electrical grid for years now. As the new film Take Back Your Power details, we have introduced even more insecurity to our grid by implementing wireless smart meters and a wireless smart grid. We have brought the vulnerabilities of the Internet to one of the most important foundations of our society, the electrical grid. Former CIA Director James Woolsey has stated that a so-called smart grid that is as vulnerable as what we've got is not smart at all. It's a really, really stupid grid. As your guests have alluded to, no one seems to be in charge. How long can we afford this before our grid is taken down? Jim Fama, fair question. Jim Fama?
Oh, I'm sorry. As far as...
I ask you, is it a stupid grid like Jim Woolsey said?
No, it's not, and it's getting smarter all the time. And smart meters are extremely useful for giving utilities information where outages are, how to route crews, those sorts of things. The listener, though, is correct that protecting smart meters from cyber intrusions is an important thing that we do.
Well, I really wanted to bring this to public attention after I became more aware of it because of your work, Rebecca Smith. And again, kudos to you. And also, Peggy Noonan had a strong, widely circulated editorial about it. What needs to be done right at the top from your perspective?
I think we need to recognize that we Americans spend over $500 billion a year for the Department of Defense. We have ships at sea, and we have airplanes, and we have all kinds of things we pay for. And we do it in the name of national security. It seems to me that protecting the grid, for which we have spent more than $1 trillion, is not an unreasonable request. We should think of this as part of our nation's security, and we should think of this as something worthy of being defended.
And John Wellinghoff, I'm wondering if listeners who want to be made more aware of the recommendations you've made, are they available, accessible on the web?
The specific items that I gave to the executives, no, they're not. I mean, and we didn't make them widely accessible because once you do that, then people start thinking about countermeasures.
Understood.
And so you want to reduce that kind of information. And I haven't been spreading that information. I've just been spreading the general word that I think those types of things need to be implemented.
And what would you say about what the public can do initially? I mean, just ordinary citizens.
Well, I think ensure that they support members of Congress that want to ultimately do what they can to, you know, put in place a system that will, in fact, protect the grid, number one. And number two, understand that we do have to pay for it. You know, if we want a secure grid, we, in fact, are going to have to put out some money to pay for it. But I think the costs would be minimal.
Well, we'll leave it there. And I want to thank you, John Wellinghoff. Thanks to Rebecca Smith. Thanks to Jim Fama. Thanks to you, our listeners. Another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to talk about women and work in the hour ahead. Joan Williams will be joining us. Hope you'll join us as well. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.